I'm very happy to have you all here with us this evening. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Bill Cassay. I am the chair of the Department of Government, Law, and International Affairs. And we're very happy to have you here tonight. I want to start by thanking everyone that's participated in Constitution Day today. I particularly want to thank all the participants, the speakers, and I'd like to single out Dr. Martin Battle and Dr. Jim Klinger for all their work organizing today. We are very fortunate tonight to have a guest speaker who is no stranger to the Constitution. Let me give you tell you a little bit about our speaker. He was a graduate of Murray State. Go Racers. He got his law degree from the University of Kentucky. Go Cats. After a distinguished career as an attorney, he moved on to become a circuit judge representing Western Kentucky. And since 2007, he's been a member of the Kentucky Supreme Court. He is also the author of 6 books, and tonight he will speak to us about the Fourth Amendment, the majesty of the ruined tenement. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming the Honorable Justice Bill Cunningham.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Can you hear me back there? Can you hear me in the back?
Okay.
I never know for sure when I'm coming to speak somewhere whether I'm going to be speaking out in the field, out on a tent, PA system, whatever, but I hope you can hear me, and thank you for coming tonight. Your time is valuable. I understand you've had a day full of Constitution, so I hope I make this worth your while. Your time is something you're going to lose being here with me tonight. I can't give it back to you. And I hope I make it worthwhile. And I hope we can have a discussion this evening, not only about our Fourth Amendment, we're going to talk about that a great deal, but about our Constitution. And this being the 225th anniversary, today, September 17, 1787, when I believe it was 29 out of the 55 delegates signed the document, which at the end of that hot, sultry summer up there in Philadelphia many years ago. How many here believe in miracles? Get them on up there now.
Quite a few. Good for you.
How many here believe in the manifest destiny of the United States? Raise those hands up. Okay. Doing good. How many believe in divine intervention? Thank you. If I were to ask those who wish they believed in those things, there'd be a lot more hands to go. We all like to believe in those things, and many of us are fortunate enough to believe it. For those who raise their hands, and for those who believe in miracles, who believe in divine intervention, who believe in manifest destiny, Constitution of the United States probably would be their Exhibit A. The miracle at Philadelphia, 1787. Catherine Drinker Bowen has written a book called The Miracle at Philadelphia. Great book. All of you, I'm sure, have read it. If you haven't, you should. When I picked up that book to read it, I thought, well, you know, this is hyperbole, but that's okay, trying to sell books. And when I read that book and when I began to study the founding of the Constitution and all that went into it, I began to realize that maybe saying that it was a miracle at Philadelphia wasn't an exaggeration. It's incredible when you consider what happened 225 years ago today. I think to really understand any of this Constitution, the Fourth Amendment, or any amendment, we have to realize exactly what went on between May 14th and September 17th of 1787. There were 55 delegates that came from varying parts of 13 states. There was geography of approximately over 1,500 miles that separated The ones from in Georgia and from the ones in Massachusetts, the Norman Tip, Northern Tip, which is, of course, now Maine. It came from Savannah, who had never seen snow. They came from northern Massachusetts when the snow had never quit falling. There were those who were not even born in America, from Scotland, from Ireland, from England, that came here, some of them as grown men. There were those who came there believing that slavery was the abomination of the devil, and there were those who came there thinking that slavery was the will of God. There are people there who came from the agrarian life of the South, those who came from the manufacturing industry, the sea-going industry of the Northeast. They spoke in different dialects, different accents, and I would say to you, probably had a hard time understanding each other. In the morning, I'm going up to northern Kentucky. I've got to go up there to give a Supreme Court law update in northern Kentucky. And even then, and even now, I have a little hard time understanding those guys from northern Kentucky. And I know they don't have any problem understanding me, because I speak the perfect King's English. But even now, you know, we go to different parts of the country and have a hard time understanding that. But you can imagine what it was in those days. And they come together, some of them taking weeks to get there. One of the delegates was even a former British soldier, Pierce Butler. Had been part of the occupying British forces here. He met a pretty American girl and got married and went to South Carolina. Those are the people who came to Philadelphia in the summer of 1787. And what did they come there for? Play a rugby game? To do something as simple as meeting each other and meet and greet and forming a club? They came to form a government. And when we see so much gridlock in our Congress today, in our State General Assembly today, and we have so much disagreement and not being able to accomplish anything, the fact that these people came together in a matter of hot, sultry months there in Philadelphia, formed together the Constitution of the United States, well, it may very well be a miracle. And it was also a miracle that it got 13 states to ratify. Rhode Island, of course, didn't even show up, but they ratified it. And you know what's also a miracle in my mind? The fact that still governs the greatest power on earth 225 years later. If you had told these founders when they went away from there in September, after they decided on September 17th, that we would be still working under that same Constitution 225 years later, they would think you had been smoking something. Incredible. And the reason that we still operate on it, because we've had 27 amendments since that time, is due in part to the amendments, but really the amendments did not save the Constitution. It's simply, you know, we got two that turned out were almost, should never have been passed. First, the prohibition, and then one repealing prohibition. You could almost wash them out as being a wash, but and so many of them have tweaked the Constitution, but none of them except the 10th Amendment and the 14th Amendment, the due process, and the 13th Amendment, and a handful have been that substantive, but many of them we would probably survive without them. So the Constitution itself, the very writing that these men put together, 1787, still exists, is a miracle. When we talk about the Fourth Amendment in a minute, we'll be stressing this. It becomes incredible when you think about this writing that we still govern by, when you think about the changes in this country. These were men that took weeks for some of them to get to Philadelphia. Today, it takes you 2 hours. During that time, doctors were putting leeches in the rear ends of people to bleed them for illnesses. Today, we have heart transplants. We go on and on with a major change, and the Constitution that they wrote is still in existence. Well, I think we all realize and understand that one of the sticking points, or three sticking points at that convention that really caused a lot of consternation. And it's really incredible that they agreed upon what they did agree upon so quickly. All of them were pretty much in agreement. Obviously, for a representative type of government, they were all pretty much in agreement. It would be a bicameral legislature. They're all pretty much in agreement. There'd be three branches of government. But there are three sticking points at that convention that really caused a consternation, and any one of which could have broken the convention wide open and everybody going home. First of all, was representation. In this bicameral legislature, you're going to have two chambers. The large states want both chambers determined by what? By population, of course. The small states, no. We've been overran by England for too long, and we'll just turn ourselves in to be ruled by another tyranny, and that is by the tyranny of the big states. This conflict went on for a long time. It almost became a deal breaker. Came closer than anything else of breaking the convention down into failure and dissolution. I think it was James Wilson. James Wilson from Scotland did not come to the United States till he was 24 years old. Benjamin Franklin called him a blazing light of intellect. I know he was the one that came up with the Three-Fifths Compromise on slaves, and I think he was the one that came up eventually with the ingenious plan of having one chamber determined by population and the other would guarantee two members for each state, and giving each separate authority and that checks and balance. Brilliant, ingenious plan, evidence of which is this still used and in existence today. Now, we may not think they're doing much up there for us, but at least it's still functioning. Another one of the big issues was slavery, of course. And we can fault the founding fathers, they didn't do away with slavery right there once and for all, but that was not going to be done. It was either have a country or not have a country. It was a deal breaker. Had the representatives there started talking seriously about drafting a constitution where slavery would be abolished, they would not be able to come back to fight another day because the Southern delegation was just packed up and gone. It was the beginning of the debate, and we were able to provide in the Constitution to permit Congress to end the slave trade after 1808, which was some compromise that they made. And then it got into an interesting argument, which one that fascinates us even to this day. The whole idea of people owning property, owning slaves, has to be with the notion that maybe they were inferior. But the Southern states were arguing that slaves be counted as a full human being. An individual. The Northern states said, no. They have no voting rights. They have no influence. We're not going to let you count them for purposes of apportioning the representation in your House of Representatives. And here again is where James Wilson came with the compromise. And it sounds, in some respects today, 225 years later, a little bit ludicrous. Three-fifths. You mean they consider them three-fifths of a human being? South wanted to consider them a whole human being. North said, no, they have no influence. In reality, it's giving over representation. This compromise was sold to the convention, and once again, they were able to move on instead of moving home. The third controversy, which to me is perhaps the most intriguing because the votes on it were so close, our government could be much different today, was the executive branch. Keep in mind, they wanted an executive branch, but they are also very leery of it because of just coming out from under a monarch some 10, 15 years before. They wanted a weak executive, but they wanted an executive nevertheless. And it was never written in stone anywhere in Philadelphia before the final draft was made that the executive would be one person. A committee of three was submitted as being an appropriate executive branch of government. And then finally, they settled on one. And perhaps the closest they came to changing our government today was the debate on how are we going to select. that one person. Well, that debate went on for some time, and it was very heated, and there were some that said, we'll throw it open for popular election. Some said, no, we'll let the governors of the state elect the executive. No, we'll let the state government select the executive. And no, we'll let the Congress select the President of the United States. And that was the one that came the closest to being this option that they would have, or the selection they made, other than the one that they ultimately made. And I wonder sometimes how much different our country would be today. It'd be like a parliamentary type government, like England. If our Congress elected, majority of Congress elected our president instead of the popular vote, it would be interesting to know what would have been the plight of this country on that kind of system. But as you know, finally voted, and there was again a compromise with selection, the popular vote, with the Electoral College, which today makes it kind of archaic and in many ways unfair. Because if you're in a state that's overwhelmingly for one other candidate, you're basically wasting your vote if you're supporting a candidate that has no way of winning your state when you go vote for that candidate. But we have it. We have popular election for the Electoral College. Those are the three things that basically were the most challenging issues. But even then, there were unhappy people, weren't there? Even then, there were complaints about this does not protect us enough from the strong central government. We need some built-in rights. We need some rights in this Constitution. It protects us from the government. And from that hard experience that we've had, we need to protect ourselves from the strong central government being able to do those things which we fought against for because England, Great Britain, our mother country, we don't want to exchange one monarch for another. And that's the way a lot of them looked at it. So here's the rights. We want certain rights. We want the right against unlawful search and seizure. We want the right against self-incrimination. We want the right to visit and to, among each other, and to redress a wrong. And we want the freedom of speech. We want the freedom of press. James Mason was the one who then proposed, as you know, Bill of Rights. Let's have these Bill of Rights in this Constitution. And it kind of came up at the very end of the convention. And James Madison was against the Bill of Rights, as was Alexander Hamilton. And their argument was, you don't need the Bill of Rights because we have limited the powers of the federal government. And what they don't have, you're going to have as a people, and you're going to have in sovereign states. But there was a gentleman's agreement, pretty much, made by James Madison and other influential men, that we passed the Constitution as it is. It's ratified, and it really got into the discussion in the ratification convention. It's ratified the way it is. We'll come back, and we will propose 10 amendments, or not 10 amendments, but amendments. At the time, the number was unsettled. And that's exactly what they did. Interestingly enough, James Madison, who, of course, had a great hand in the Constitution and was against the Bill of Rights being in the Constitution, was true to his word, and he helped lead the fight and helped to write the Bill of Rights, which came out of basically 22, which was distilled down to 12, and only 10 were approved. Oddly enough, one of those was rejected later on, became our 27th Amendment. So it took a time for then it to get around to being accepted, but it finally got here. And that is the one limiting the increase or decrease of compensation of members of Congress during their respective terms. So we ended up with the 10 amendments. And, of course, they're all important. Some kind of fell by the wayside. All of them important. But the two I want to talk to you a little bit tonight about, and ones that all of us they're involved in the criminal justice system, is the Fourth Amendment. And another one I'm going to just talk to you about in passing before we open it up for questions, is the Tenth Amendment, states' rights, because it's had an interesting past. Question is whether or not it even has a future, interesting or otherwise. But I will say this. It was the 10th Amendment to the Constitution, but it was first and foremost in the ratifiers of those amendments. That was the most important amendment, state sovereignty. Because they knew that if they were able to maintain state sovereignty, they could preserve and protect all these other rights that fell behind. So at that particular time, the 10th Amendment was the most important amendment. Today, you can make an argument that it's on life support, but we'll talk about that in a minute. Let's talk about the 4th Amendment. You know, the whole soul and spirit of the 4th Amendment was caught up in the eloquent words of William Pitt. It still moves us, and probably the most quoted statement made in regard to the 4th Amendment. And in Parliament, William Pitt said, "The poorest man may in his cottage bid defiance to all the forces of the crown. It may be frail, its roof may shake, the wind may blow through it, the storm may enter into it, the rain may enter, but the King of England, he cannot enter. All his forces dare not cross the threshold of the ruined tenement." You know, I've always been thrilled by those words. In my career as criminal justice, as defense lawyer, as Commonwealth attorney, as circuit judge, Supreme Court, I've kind of grown to adopt the 4th Amendment. It's probably my favorite. Hard to pick favorites when you have these valuable rights. But William Pitt's words envision it to me that it doesn't make any difference whether you're rich or poor. It doesn't make any difference whether you live in a hovel or whether you live in a Grand Avenue mansion in New York City. Your place of abode, not only your place of abode, but your personal effects, your property, your house, your property and effects are protected against the power of the government. You know, another thing that's interesting about our 4th Amendment is perhaps no other amendment has had as much litigation as the 4th Amendment. If you go to law school, or if you're a lawyer, criminal lawyer, the 4th Amendment pops up almost on everything. There's been so much litigation in the Supreme Court. Over 220 years, the nature of persons, houses, papers, and effects have changed drastically. You know, a confession is pretty much still a confession, whether it was in 1787 or today. A jury, a right to a jury, or the 6th Amendment, it's still pretty well everybody understands what a jury means. Maybe a difference in numbers, maybe a difference in voting pattern, but a jury pretty much means the same thing today as it did in 1787. Freedom of speech, you understand that just as well as the Founding Fathers in 1787 understood it. The freedom to worship and believe the way you want to, you understand that today. It means the same thing. It means exactly the same thing. But when you talk about the 4th Amendment and you talk about these terms, persons, houses, papers, and effects have changed drastically. Today they include internet, cell phones, computers as effects, and was even interpreted in a recent case we'll touch upon, U.S. versus Jones, as by Justice Scalia, to include vehicles. And maybe that's why we've had so much litigation, is because these things have been so much intransient throughout the 225 years. My question is the sentiment that is expressed by William Pitt still alive today? Is it still vibrant? You know, your right to counsel is contaminated. Because if you are a multi-billionaire, the quality of your counsel is not going to be the same as someone who's unemployed going on a Social Security check. Quality of your counsel is going to depend upon how much you own, how wealthy you are. So my question becomes, is it the same thing for the 4th Amendment? If you live in the nicest house in town and you have the most influence of anybody in town, it's in nearer to you to have more protection by the Fourth Amendment than someone who lives in public housing? Or is the Fourth Amendment today still carry with it exactly the same spirit of what William Pitt spoke about? And I say to you, absolutely. Absolutely. I bring proof to you tonight. I'm going to share with you a recent case by the Kentucky State Supreme Court, Commonwealth versus Guzman. This rendered last month. This case graphically illustrates the point that William Pitt was making, even now here in 2012.